Snowy owls are starting to become regular visitors here in Wisconsin. This is the third winter in a row that the birds have been here in big numbers. The DNR said this week that 271 of the large white owls have been seen in Wisconsin.
Chuck Kornbach reports that bird watchers, also in big numbers, are paying attention.
Just east of the Horicon National Wildlife Refuge last Saturday afternoon, about 30 drivers parked their vehicles on a town road. The caravan has braved ice, wind, and light snow to come see a snowy owl known to hang out in the area and spotted earlier in the day by a volunteer birder. The tip is correct, and people get out of their cars to take a look across about 100 yards of a snow-covered farm field. Horicon Marsh Bird Club president Jeff Balls points out the roughly 2-foot-tall owl.
He's just kind of hunkered down. Now you notice the wind's out of the south. He's on the north side of that stump. He's probably in a pretty good spot, blocking a little bit of the wind. He's got a good place to see. This is his roost, so, you know, he's chilling now.
People look at the snowy owl through binoculars or other viewing devices. A Madison couple, who give their names as Laura and Dylan, say this is the first snowy they've seen.
We've tried 3 or 4 times before to see snowy owls at Governor Dodge and in this neighborhood in the past years, and we've never succeeded. So,
and as I just saw in the scope, they're just a beautiful bird.
The owl also gave the bird watchers another thrill by flying and showing off its 4-foot wingspan. The snowy owls aren't just at Horicon, of course. A website map titled ebird.org shows reports of the owls across most of Wisconsin. And a scientific collaboration called Project Snowstorm notes thousands of snowies, called an eruption, from Minnesota to Newfoundland. Project naturalist Scott Widensall says no one knows why so many owls have come south out of the Arctic. But he says it helped that adult owls had many lemmings to eat in northern Canada last summer, laid lots of eggs, and many baby owls survived. Widensall says the southerly migration is a little mysterious.
It may have had something to do with an unusually snowy, cold winter in the eastern Canadian Arctic that hit early with very deep snowpack so that the owls weren't able to get to the lemmings as easily as possible. It may have had something to do with prevailing winds. Kind of one of the charms about these eruptions is that they're so completely unpredictable.
Project Snowstorm and its local partners have placed tiny transmitters on 3 snowy owls in Wisconsin, near Wisconsin Rapids, Appleton, and Kewaunee. Widensall says so far the birds are staying within a few miles of where they were tagged.
That they were obviously finding a landscape that appeals to them because they're looking for places that are kind of wide open and flat and relatively treeless, like the Arctic tundra they came from.
Widensall says the 3 birds are also finding a lot of food, probably rodents. This winter's snowy owl eruption helped bring about 75 people to an annual owl prowl the DNR offers at Horicon every year. Last Saturday night, people heard a talk about owls, got to see a stuffed snowy recently found dead, and join DNR wildlife educator Liz Hertzman on a hike through the marsh to call for owls found in Wisconsin. Here she played a recording of a screech owl. And Hertzman imitated the trill of a screech. No owls called back that night, but naturalists say you have about another month or so in Wisconsin to look, call, or listen for the snowy owl before the Arctic visitors head north. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
For the first time ever, a type of fish has been taken off of the endangered species list. Last week, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced that the Oregon chub, a 3-inch fish, was being delisted. And we just found out from our guest that another fish has just joined it. The chub, by the way, had already gone from endangered to threatened status before being taken off.
Also last week, some Republicans in Congress called for revisions to the Endangered Species Act, saying it's too easy to put species on the list and too hard to take them back off again.
Stanley Temple joins us now to explain what it takes to get on and off that list and the impact generally of the Endangered Species Act on conservation efforts. He's Professor Emeritus of Conservation, Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Stan, welcome back to the show.
Good to be back.
What does it take to get a species, first of all, on the Endangered Species List?
Well, the most common way that they end up on the list is for some individual or organization to submit a petition to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service or the National Marine Fisheries Service, providing some biological justifications for why they think the species should be listed. In response to that, the federal agencies do an extensive review to determine whether the facts are correct and warrant listing. And if it passes that test, the species is proposed as a candidate for listing. Species can linger for some time as candidate species before they ultimately do get listed.
And then what kind of protections do I get if I'm an endangered species?
Well, compared to other wildlife species, the protection does get increased in that you can't do things that would harm the species. But for endangered species, one of those potential harms that is somewhat unique to the Endangered Species Act is the concept of critical habitats. And so many species are threatened by the loss of habitat. The Endangered Species Act specifically tends to provide an extra measure of protection to the habitat that an endangered species needs to thrive.
I was wondering about that, whether it was too or mostly individual focused on that particular animal or the ecosystem that it lives in more generally.
Well, if you look at the broad purpose of the Endangered Species Act, obviously first and foremost is to prevent species from going extinct. But in the wording of the Endangered Species Act, it also says that a second purpose is to protect the ecosystems on which the species depends. And quite often an endangered species, because of their high profile, because of the extra protection that they receive, they can provide what we often call umbrella protection for lots of other species that share the same habitat and live in the same ecosystem.
Do you know roughly how many species have made it onto that list over the years?
We've got about a little over 1,500 species have been on the list. Some of those are native species. Some of them are international species. So over the years, the 40 years now that the endangered species has been around, we've been accumulating endangered species. That's a reflection of the fact that more and more species are really warranting this type of special protection.
Well, what led me to give you a holler was this news that the Oregon chub, had been taken off the list, the first fish species. And you mentioned just before we started talking, another species. You can tell us about that. But how common is it for species to get delisted?
Well, the Oregon chub and the other one that came off is the Modoc sucker, mm-hmm. two species that have sort of unfortunate names. but these two species are really quite illustrative. Both of them were placed on the endangered species list as a result of petitions from citizens. The Oregon chub was petitioned by citizens to be added to the list in 1993, so not that long ago. It triggered some immediate responses that were relatively easy to put in place. It was mostly improving streamside habitats, getting cattle out of streams, relatively simple things that probably had lots of other beneficial impacts as well. And the species responded impressively and came off essentially just 15 years after it had been listed.
You mentioned that the main purpose of the act is to prevent these species from going extinct. Have we gotten in too late sometimes?
In very few cases. Over the entire 40-year history of the Endangered Species Act, it has been notably successful at preventing extinctions in that only 1% of the species that have been listed have gone extinct. And several of those were actually species that, in retrospect, were already extinct at the time that they were listed.
What do you mean by that? There were still some individuals left, but it was too late, or we didn't know that they were all gone yet?
We didn't know they were all gone yet and listed them and subsequently discovered that, oops, it's too late. Mm. But only 1% have been lost. And if you look at it even in a different way and say, well, has it been successful in moving species to a better status? You can say that definitely over two-thirds, actually almost three-quarters of the species that have been listed are now either stable or increasing in numbers.
Have we missed some along the way, species that have gone extinct and we hadn't even noticed and hadn't filed for this protection in the first place?
Oh, absolutely. That has happened. And, of course, many species go extinct without us even knowing that they were in trouble, or in some cases that we didn't even know they existed until they were essentially gone.
I know each has its own individual story, but what are some of the most common threats that put an animal or plant species in this situation?
Well, there are four big factors. One is that we overkill them, and we have a great example of that this year with the 100th anniversary of the passenger pigeons extinction, where we simply killed them and ate them to extinction. The second way that's most prevalent today is habitat destruction. We also introduce invasive exotic species that are predators or competitors with native species. And finally, we pollute the environment.
We have conservation expert Stan Temple, Professor Emeritus at the UW-Madison, with us talking about the Endangered Species Act. A couple of fish species became the first fish to come back off of the endangered species protection over the last week or so. So we're talking about why species go on the list, what it takes to get them back off, and what the protection of the Endangered Species Act has meant for conservation here in the United States.
And you can join the conversation. Do you have thoughts on the impact of the Endangered Species Act? Do you think we're doing too much or not enough to protect species? Maybe you have a question about how the Endangered Species Act really works. You can call 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org.
We continue our conversation about endangered species. The Oregon chub last week became the first fish species to come off the federal endangered species list. Another fish species followed suit. Stan Temple of the UW-Madison is here to talk about how the Endangered Species Act works.
And you can join in with your questions and your thoughts about endangered species protection. Are we doing enough, not enough, too much? You can call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org.
We had a listener, Sally in Hartford, called in, and she wanted to know, when a species gets taken off the list, are the environmental protections that were put in place for that species rescinded? Do they just go away?
Well, yes, that's true. When a species gets delisted, a lot of the protections of the Endangered Species Act do go away, although there's a review process that follows up with the delisting just to make sure that the positive trend for the species isn't being reversed and that they're not falling back into trouble.
And Stan, you mentioned earlier some of the protections that kick in to protect these species, but what kind of resources are out there to help fund, to help bring these species back and pay for the conservation efforts?
Well, that's a big issue. In the first place, of course, we don't spend nearly enough to keep species from getting into such trouble that they end up on the endangered species list. It's basically failures that get them on the endangered species list. But once they're on, the amount of federal money that's allocated for endangered species recovery is really a pittance. It works out to about $150 million a year. And to put that in perspective, that's about what it costs for us to pave 18 miles of interstate highway. So we're really not spending very much federal money at all. A lot of money comes from private conservation organizations and states and other sources, but at the federal level, it's almost trivial.
And I imagine people in the conservation business would hope for more.
Absolutely, because when you start looking at what it is estimated to cost to recover some of these species that have gotten in such deep trouble, the numbers do start to add up. Recovering a species that's gotten on the endangered species list, it's very time-consuming. It often tends to be quite expensive.
Let's talk about some success stories apart from the fish we've touched on already. Can you point sort of a couple cases where the Endangered Species Act has made a big difference in preventing extinction?
Well, we certainly can point to species right here in Wisconsin that have been delisted, that were once endangered but have now come off the list. Peregrine falcons, bald eagles, gray wolves are three very well-known species in Wisconsin that were once very rare in the state, gone from the state, and that are now back and thriving in the state. We have species that are making steady progress toward delisting, but it does take time. So when we look across the country at species that have made really remarkable recoveries but aren't yet delisted, the whooping crane, for example, has come a long way. The black-footed ferret, the California condor, here in the Midwest, the Kirtland's warbler. All of these are species that were really in deep trouble and unquestionably would have gone extinct had it not been for the protections and recovery efforts that the endangered species focused on them.
We'll go to our phones now at 800-642-1234. We've got Jerry with us in Stockbridge. Jerry, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
We're talking about endangered species. While they're not listed as yet, I understand that they're facing imminent threat, and that would be the monarch butterfly. And apparently the largest cause, the preeminent cause, is the genetically altered crops and the use on fields with the widespread planting of genetically altered corn and soybean of Roundup, which just destroys all other plant life outside of the crop itself.
Jerry, thanks a lot for the I'm going to jump in, Jerry. Thanks a lot for the call. And we did talk about this a while back in an earlier program, an expert on monarch butterflies saying that, well, there's a core species that doesn't migrate up here that would stick around, so the species might not go extinct. We might not see them anymore because of the end of migration of the monarch butterflies.
And monarch butterflies are actually a good example of a species that we're obviously failing. They are declining, and who knows, sometime in the future they might actually reach the point where they would be considered for listing.
What kind of things would happen then? I mean, would we impose limits on agriculture if that's determined to be really a main cause, if pesticides, say, are a main cause of their near extinction, at least in our country?
Well, that's probably one of the things that would be in the repertoire, you might say, of things that they would need. But certainly we would, I think even before they were listed, we might encourage the agricultural community to leave more milkweeds on their property, since it is the milkweed plant that's so important in the life cycle of the monarch butterfly.
How contentious is the decision to list a species as threatened or endangered when it runs into economic interests or some kind of political interest? How much back and forth is there on that?
Well, there's a lot. And, of course, over the 40 years, there have been repeated attempts to try to deauthorize the Endangered Species Act completely or defund it or modify it, almost always prompted by attacks from industry-based special interests that are inconvenienced by the presence and needs of an endangered species. But in general, the process of listing a species has been based on biological information. One of the proposals that is likely to be introduced this year by Congress is going to require a much more extensive analysis of economic impacts before a listing could take place. That's a pretty substantial change.
When we're looking at endangered species, some really capture the imagination, often big ones or cute ones, eagles, polar bears, that sort of thing. A lot of the species are more obscure, though. Can you make the case, why do we want to preserve a species that maybe isn't that poster child of the animal or plant world? What do we get out of it?
Well, you have to go back to why we had the Endangered Species Act in the first place, which was a major turning point in our relationship with wildlife. Up to that point, we had been primarily concerned only about conserving and protecting species that we used as resources that were somehow valuable to us. And the Endangered Species Act instead took, rather than an economic argument, it took an ethical argument that said it's unethical for human beings to cause other species to go extinct. And the Endangered Species Act sets out as a national policy that we as a country are going to do everything we can to prevent our native species from disappearing.
I know you've done a lot of work on the writing of Aldo Leopold. Was he a key player in introducing this idea that our ethics as humans should involve other species and keeping them from going extinct?
Aldo Leopold was absolutely central in this concept, and he introduced it to the world in his book, A Sand County Almanac, as a land ethic, The idea that we as people are just one member of the biological community of organisms on this planet, and that we should have a moral code of conduct on how we live in that community, just the same way we have codes of conduct about how we live within human communities.
Looking toward the future, earlier in the show, in fact, we talked about climate change. How big a role is that going to play in the future of species being threatened with extinction?
It's enormous. When we look at the predictions about what our inability to cope with climate change could mean, the endangered species list will grow very, very rapidly if things progress the way they are predicted to be under business as usual.
And does the Endangered Species Act have the power to apply to something like carbon emissions? And that's a pretty tall order. That whole economic and political argument we talked about earlier would be exponentially magnified if we have this conflict.
I would certainly hope that we can deal with the problem of climate change without invoking the Endangered Species Act as the reason why we're going to do something. There are so many other economically based, social based issues that should come into play far before the Endangered Species Act. But certainly, if a species was threatened by climate change, it would have to be considered under the provisions of the Endangered Species Act.
Before we wrap up, Stan, you've been watching these issues for a long time. Do you, at this point in your career, have an optimistic feeling about the future of keeping animals and plants from going extinct?
My standard response to that is I'm not optimistic. An optimist is someone who knows the odds are in their favor. Mm. I'm hopeful. A hopeful person knows the odds are against them, but thinks it's still worth putting in a good effort to try to make it happen.
Stan, thanks a lot for joining us today. That was Stanley Temple, UW-Madison Professor Emeritus of Conservation, Forest, and Wildlife Ecology, talking about the Endangered Species Act after the first ever fish species were taken off that list.